10 o'clock. Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Daniel Schwartz, I'm with San Francisco Travel. I'm just going to be introducing this wonderful panel today. First of all, this is flying high, a 36,000 foot view of the aviation industry. So that's what everybody's here for. Everyone wants to hear.
Okay.
Excellent. Okay, terrific. Well, we have two wonderful presenters today, both experts in the judging. You know, I've seen. Well,
they're back there.
Judging by the length of their bios, they're both experts.
Which you're not going to read.
Oh, no?
Alfredo was bribing people to come to the session.
So you have Alfredo Gonzalez, who founded AG Hospitality Group in 2017 after spending 2 years as the VP of Global Development at Visit Florida. Previously, he was a senior VP of Global Development for Brand USA in Washington, D.C., and that was after 15 years with the Greater Fort Lauderdale Convention and Visitors Bureau as the Vice President of International Sales. In addition to Alfredo, we have Will Birchelman, and he is currently the Director of Air Service Development with Volare Aviation. Previously, he's held jobs with both Southwest and American Airlines in network planning capacities, and has worked with industry analysis, code-sharing planning, revenue management, and schedule production. So they both have some wonderful insights. Welcome. And one reminder, please, before you leave after the session, fill out those forms. They're really easy to fill out, and they help IATA out a lot as a member of the summit committee. I can say that they really do. So
thank you very much.
Thank you both.
All right. Okay. Well, thank you for coming. And as you know, the airline industry changes daily. And I thought when they asked me to do this, I think I did it last year. It's the relation with the airlines and tourism. It's not just the airlines, not tourism, but the combination that has actually become very successful in lately in attracting air service. And I thought about Will, because actually Will works for us at the Daytona Beach International Airport. Today I'm also representing St. Petersburg International Airport. But I always tell them that I think they have a crystal ball in their office in Dallas, because they know something about the airlines before the airlines know it's going to happen. And his partner, Chris, who I've known for years, I said, look, Chris, are you available? Is Will available? He goes, Will might be available. So when he called me, he says, I can do this. I'm like, excellent, because his information, what you're going to see today, some things you might recognize, but some of the things are actually pretty surprising of what's going on. So with that said, we have about a 30-plus minute presentation. After that, let's really get involved in some Q&A, because let's use Will and that amazing crystal ball information that you have, you can share as we help the CVBs and DMOs and the industry get in more involved with what's going on in aviation.
Absolutely.
So yours, sir.
Nice to meet everyone. Before I begin, is there anyone here who has any kind of tangential experience with airlines or... Okay. What have you done in the past?
Use a flight attendant for the Wright brothers.
The flight attendant.
I love you too. My last position was station manager for Florida Express at Orlando International Airport.
Okay.
I did work sales, flight attendant, ticket agent.
Flight attendant.
I was flight attendant with the original Continental Airlines.
Nice.
I have Sky Miles.
All right.
And I slept at a Holiday Inn last night.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, this is a very fun industry. It's exciting. It's always changing. And I think now more than ever, the airline side of the industry, but really hospitality in general, we're really a beacon of light around the world. I mean, we're kind of, you know, stitching together all these nationalities, and there are no political borders in the travel industry. We're all one team, and I think it's great. And it's, as I said, now more than ever in the world, we need that. So I'm glad everyone's here. So today we're going to talk a little bit about the air service landscape, what's going on, because as I said, it is always changing. So for those of you who've been around for a while, so back in the 80s, we had 40-ish airlines that were flying in this country. That was after deregulation, which happened in the late 70s. And so what that did is that caused a huge proliferation of new airlines that came onto the scene, offered really, really cheap fares, but not necessarily good business models. And so a lot of these airlines didn't make it. Mm-hmm. And so between mergers, acquisitions, two Gulf Wars, diseases, blood pestilence, we got to where we are now, which are these five major carriers. Now, of course, this isn't the entire industry. You can add into that additional five-ish major carriers, so the Frontier, Allegiant, JetBlue. We'll talk more about those in a second, but suffice it to say, the industry is much, much smaller than it was before, at least in terms of airlines. But don't be fooled, because although the number of carriers is smaller, there actually are far more passengers traveling today. And that's kind of goes against conventional wisdom if you just look at the numbers of carriers. So just how concentrated is this market? Well, these airlines generate almost 85% of the revenue. So when I say these airlines, I'm talking about American, Delta, United, Southwest. They also fly 75% of the capacity in the country. So while if you're in Florida or Las Vegas, you might see a lot of Allegiant planes flying around, or Spirit or Frontier, what have you. In the grand scheme of things, they're not that big yet. I think that's going to change as time goes on. We're starting to see that shift. But for now, we've got the majors. So to that point, look at the growth of all these carriers. So I didn't mention Hawaiian originally because, you know, in relative terms, they're actually pretty small, even though they do fly to the mainland. But we do include them as a low-cost carrier because they do offer a good value product for that market. But Alaska, Allegiant, Frontier, those lines represent how many places they flew to in 2007 versus 2019. So you see an incredible spike, especially at Allegiant and Frontier. Now, having said that, Southwest is not on here. So Southwest maybe hasn't added that many destinations, but Southwest is so big that even if they just add 1 or 2% capacity to their system, that actually equals like half of these guys combined. So they're still a very formidable force. And I always mention about Southwest because as someone who used to work there, you know, Southwest has this reputation sometimes of not always having the lowest fare. But what people have to remember is that while Southwest may not always have the lowest fare, their presence in a market still fundamentally lowers the average fares that are published for all passengers. So because planes are more full, maybe Southwest doesn't have as many of their cheapest seats available, but their fare structure is still there. That's exactly right. So when you hear people say that, especially, you know, as tourism folks, it's always a good sort of soundbite to give people and let them know that Southwest is still great.
So, I mean, airlines like Frontier, based out of Denver, 10 years ago, this is what the map looked like for Frontier 10 years ago. This is today. That's today from Frontier.
Wow.
And they actually, Frontier is one of my clients, and they're starting service internationally now. So you'll be having Frontier to Guatemala, Costa Rica, El Salvador. They started Dominican Republic. So now you have a low fare carrier that's following the models of Southwest and going into the international markets as well. If we look at Spirit, based when they were moved from Detroit to Fort Lauderdale, this is 10 years ago. This is Spirit today. Amazing growth. And you can see the growth is not just domestic. You look at the penetration into Central and South America and the Caribbean, it's pretty significant. And if you look at Allegiant as well, this was when they had the two hubs, one in the east, one in the west, 10 years ago. Today, they use the same hubs, but look at the growth of city pairings. And that's what's important about this is the city pairings. These airports are not just using your main hub airport, they're using secondary airports. And that's where we really come to play, that everybody in the country now, if you have the facility, you have the possibility of having air service. It's not like the 70s where it was dominated by a JFK, Newark, Dallas. This environment actually, everybody can play.
All right, so we talked about the changing landscape of the industry. So let me explain these two lines. So the line on top, that's the capacity. That's the number of seats that are available for sale. The red line below, enplanements, that's the number of passengers. You go back to the early 90s. On average, if you picked any flight, maybe only 50% of the seats were full. But now, today, it's 81%. And a lot of that has to do with the mergers and acquisitions. But I don't know about you, but sometimes I get on a plane, I'm in some, you know, far-flung city in the middle of the night, and I think to myself, where in the heck are all these people going? But then again, I realize, but I'm one of these people too. I mean, there's just, people are going everywhere, and they're flying on, you know, there's more demand, but they're also flying on relatively fewer seats compared to that demand. So load factors are slowly going up. Now, what's happening with airfares? I think part of the reason why you see flights being more full is that the average airfare has come down. So if you think back to the early 90s, even when you had the likes of Southwest and other low-cost carriers starting into the market, that was the average one-way fare. So you think that on average, most people were paying close to $600-ish. And since that's the average, a lot of people are paying a lot more than that. So airfare is just far more affordable than it was back then. And this even includes the ancillary fees that airlines are charging. So the baggage fees, et cetera, et cetera. So we're still in a much better place than we were several decades ago. This industry, we're one of these, we're just an industry where we just can't seem to make money until recently. but finally, in the past decade, things have turned around. I can't do the math right off my head, but I believe the industry's lost close to $50 billion in the period leading up to 2010, but then made up for all that money in the past decade. And again, that was the consolidation, that was better control of pricing. And the big saver really has been the ancillary fees and being able to sort of offset rising fuel costs. Speaking of which, I thought this was a really interesting antidote. So literally, if you want to figure out how much fuel impacts industry, one U.S. penny equals $200 million that are added to the airline's bottom line. So when you hear, oh, the price of fuel went up $5, I mean, you do the math. I mean, these are adding
astronomical.
Yeah, exactly. It only takes a few pennies to wipe out profits for an entire airline. Just like today, by the same token, you could have one or two flights in the airline's network that are losing money, and those two flights alone could be enough to swing an airline from black to red. So this airline or this industry represents one that just operates on razor thin margins. So pilot shortage.
Wow. So we have some issues.
Wow. Yeah.
We have some real things to think about when it comes to one of the problems with the pilots. Let's look at the next slide. What's happening right now is the FAA is requiring pilots to have at least 1,500 hours of flight service. The problem is that they can't get flight service if they don't have a job. So we're actually having to look at pilots that are being trained in other countries or military. Now, it's okay, but some of the airlines that were hiring, like, pilots that were in Air Somalia or, and I'm not joking, we had to find pilots in other countries just so they could get to 1,500 hours. And the other is the mandatory age of 65. So you have a problem there. So one of the things we were talking earlier is how do we fix this? Now, we are actually in several, like Embry-Riddle, the airline school, is doing a lot to attract not only U.S.-based pilots, but also training pilots from overseas here in the States so they actually fulfill the criteria to be a pilot. So what are the things,
this is a global problem, right? Because there's international airlines looking for pilots, too.
Right. That's right. You have these international airlines that are, growing precipitously, and so they need these pilots. Right. Now, they don't necessarily face the same restrictions as far as the 1,500 hours, but there's still a finite pool.
How about the age?
I'm not as well versed in the retirement age, say if you're at Emirates or Qatar or something.
But I mean, I think that this is the age. I think it's pretty standard.
Okay.
Because I mean, the FAA pretty much is the governing body, so I'm sure that but again, I don't know what the FAA would do in Central Africa or maybe in some central countries in South America, where you have an airline that has four or five airplanes, they're going to utilize those pilots as much as they can.
The 1,500 hours are in the particular airplane, or can they be 1,500 hours like Air Force?
They can be multiple aircraft.
Okay. So on training, financial burden, that's for the airline, or that's for the...
That's for the individual.
For the individual.
It's very expensive. Yes.
Right.
But didn't they used to be, they used to pay you to get trained?
Well, a strong pipeline for drones used to be the military. Going through probably the 90s, but what happened is as the pool of pilots decreased and people started in the military started to have a pilot shortage, and they still have a pilot shortage. So it's just created a really big issue. And I want to go quickly back to this slide. So you see these numbers here, and you think, oh, my God, we're going to hell in a handbasket. We're never going to be able to fly these planes. Maybe. But one of the things that airlines are doing to offset some of these challenges is you see carriers like JetBlue, I know American Eagle's doing it, and a couple others I can't think of right hand. They've established their own, SkyWest is doing this as well. They've established their own pipelines. What they're doing is they're either setting up their own training schools, or as Alfredo mentioned, they've partnered with some of the aeronautical institutions. And what it does is it essentially guarantees graduates of those schools an interview with one of these big carriers. And so, but we're still going to see this gap between demand for pilots and planes needed to operate the airline systems. And that's because it's going to take a while to get all these pilots schooled up and trained.
And then you had the training is very expensive, but the starting salaries are ridiculously low. If you're flying Calm Air, I think the starting salary for a pilot, co-pilot, was in like $22,000 a year.
You can make
your
money flipping burgers at McDonald's. I mean, this is like scary stuff, you think. Yeah.
Making more money with Uber.
I know Spirit has a program where there's some tuition reimbursement. If you're an employee of Spirit and you're training to be a pilot, they pay for part of your school. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
So does Norwegian. And you're
Norwegian,
yes,
yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
And it is 65, by the way, international. The Civic
Everywhere.
International Authority. But some countries may opt to increase it.
They never met a Pan Am pilot, though.
Yeah, they actually flew the original. Yeah.
Okay. You will still hear naysayers saying, oh, it'll be fine. Because what happened was, at least in the U.S., the retirement age was increased from, it was 60 to 65.
Well, 60 to 62.
60 to 65, right. So it bought us some time. But we're sort of at a watershed moment now where we're going to have a mass exodus of all the people that sort of benefited from that increased retirement age, leaving the system and then trying to get those new folks in. So what does that mean for airports in general, and specifically for folks like you who are working in inbound travel and tourism? So because we see the shortage of pilots, there just aren't enough planes to fly all these flights. So you see airlines using larger planes. We'll see that in a second in the subsequent slide. But it's really the non-hub markets that have been hit the hardest. So it's not so much tourism markets. So, you know, places like Las Vegas and London and those places that have a strong inbound tourism demand aren't really seeing that much of an impact. But in the U.S., for the most part, it's really the small markets that face the risk of essentially being disconnected from the global aviation network. And that's a scary thing. And I think airlines recognize that, because more than ever, we do need to be connected to the global marketplace, because that's the future.
Can I ask a question?
Sure.
So this previous slide, mm-hmm. how does this map onto the fact that more airlines are flying to more airports than ever before? Right, so you showed the difference
mm-hmm.
from 2010 to 2020 or 2019, and those maps are crazy with busyness, but this is showing that we have less departures?
So what it's showing is, while seats have increased, overall, in some of the smaller markets, you're seeing departures decrease. That's what's happening. So if you're at a big hub,
so they've decreased in more places,
right?
More places,
right. And this slide is
also
a U.S.
bigger planes, so
yeah.
less flights.
Uh-huh. Yeah, we have a slide about that coming up.
Yeah.
Sure, very good.
Okay. And what you'll see a lot, and this is something that I don't like to see what's going on, an airline that will remain nameless will make an announcement that they're flying from point A to point B, and they'll have it for 90 days and cut it. So it actually gets the destination all excited. Oh my God, I just got that new flight.
You put it on the map.
And it goes. And that's because they can. Or what they need to do, based on pilot shortage or the planes, is that they'll relocate the plane somewhere else. So it'll appear on the route.
Right.
But you won't
right.
see American canceling Dallas, but you will see something happening in Ocala, Florida, or somewhere like that.
Right.
They even have an airport, but
yeah.
Fort Myers, it happened in Fort Myers. Eurowings.
Yeah, that's a really, yeah, that's right. Okay, so to your point, the way all airlines are offsetting this pilot shortage is they're decreasing the number of departures, but using larger aircraft. So it's created this cascade effect where markets that used to be served by 50-seaters are now being served by, instead of having five flights in a 50-seater, they have two or three flights on a 76-seater. So the net effect is either flat or in some cases actually increased capacity, but fewer operations. And you see this very distinctly, even just going back to 2011. In 2011, and we'll just focus on the red line, average seats per departure around 100. And that was sort of the last gasp of the heyday of the 50-seaters. You know, people have all kinds of terrible names for those days, and they're not fun to fly in all the time. So I can't say that there's any love lost that they're being parked, but it's been a good thing though for communities that only had those planes, because now they have, I think, planes with better products. So you fast forward to 2020, and now the average departure is around 123 seats. So you've seen a 25% increase in the aircraft size used in a lot of markets.
And we have examples like, for example, Elite Airways uses these CRJs, the 200, 700 series. They did the study and they said, oh yeah, this is great. We can fly from, let's say, Daytona to Newark. The problem is when they factored in the numbers of fuel and operation, they said, no, we, in order to fly that route, we need at least 140 passengers. So as much as the airline wanted to fly to that destination, the aircraft was not big enough in order to, for the revenue management to say, you know, that's a profitable route. Mm-hmm. So you might want it, and they might want it, but when they factor in the cost, they say, no, it's got to be a bigger plane.
Okay, so you raise a really good point. I think this addresses it. At least in the U.S., the key to an airline being successful today, yes, of course, it's pricing, of course, it's passenger demand, but really it's all about the real estate. Real estate in the U.S. now is at a premium, and while there are airports that are building new terminals or expanding, it's going to take a while for that to catch up. So I won't go through every single one of these, but suffice it to say, you've got airports that are either slot exhausted, so there's no more slots available, they're constrained, or most of the time, gate space exhausted is really the issue. So you have some of the largest hubs in this country where the hub carrier would love to grow, but they'd love to grow like tomorrow, but they can't because they just simply don't have enough gates available. And I think while airports in general did a really great job of anticipating demand, I don't think anyone really expected the explosion of air service demand that happened during this current economic boom.
So, Will, how are they working some of the airports with curfews? Because now you see like departures at 1:30 in the morning, 2:20 in the morning. Are the communities working with the airport, the airline, to avoid the curfews?
Well, so there are. I mean, fortunately, there aren't a lot of airports that have curfews, but for those that do, some of them are voluntary. So I know, living in Dallas, I actually right next to Love Field where Southwest Airlines is. So there's a voluntary curfew. I think it's 11 p.m. But now I'm laying in bed at midnight. I hear jets whizzing by, and I think what airlines are trying to do is they're trying to extend their operating day where possible. So it used to be that by 9 or 10 o'clock, most of the flights were done at a hub. Now, especially in the summertime, you have departure pushes at midnight, sometimes 1 a.m., going to all these places. And that's an attempt to maximize the
utilization,
limited number of pilots, limited number of planes. And you can be in Atlanta and be pushing at 11:30 at night on a cross-country flight. So that's pretty much the norm nowadays. Okay.
So here's, we're still trying to deal with the whole 737 MAX. Right now, I believe they were looking at March 31
mm-hmm.
for, it's going to get, well, they're trying to find out, first it was this module that caused the crash, the 7. But now they're finding out there's other problems that now they're going to basically have to redesign the 737. Now, you got airlines like Southwest that only has 737s. It's a major impact to them because they would like to grow, but they have 100 aircraft that they can't utilize. And the aircraft model, that 737, WestJet, Southwest, this is the main workhorse of the domestic fleet. So we do have a problem there.
And the impact is not just on the routes that have the 737 MAX or scheduled. It's this... they're sort of behind the scenes things that aren't necessarily evident. So, for example, I was just at United not too long ago, and we were talking about this very issue. And the way they explained it is, much like I was explaining earlier about airlines using bigger planes, markets at United previously scheduled a 737 are now being swapped for, say, some of these bigger regional jets. So it's even markets that maybe were flying a wide body, they've had to sort of shift all their capacity around to accommodate this gap. So it's not just, you know, a one-for-one trade. It's a knock-on effect that happens across the entire fleet. And they told us flat out, they're like, guys, you know, I'm glad you're here trying to, you know, woo us to serve your market, but things are pretty much on hold right now.
So you think it's like for the Airbus, that the 320, 321s, those are just flying off the market right now?
Oh, yeah. I mean, for those who are kind of airplane geeks, the 321, when it first came out, I mean, it was a dog. I mean, like back in the 90s, but now, I mean, it's the holy grail. I mean, it is the 757 replacement. So that's the plane that airlines are going to be using, such as JetBlue, to fly across the Atlantic to
and
Europe.
Some of the airlines that are
starting very,
to look
very
at low-fare carriers that are looking at these new aircraft from Airbus, there's a 321 now, XLR,
mm-hmm.
and one of the airlines here is already planning to fly from the East Coast to Europe on this. It's called the XLR, and it'll have probably about the same range of some of the wide-body jets that we're using on the legacy carriers, and that is going to be on a low fare carrier. I think it's going to modify the whole rate structure as we fly to Europe.
That's right. Okay, I'm going to pass the baton here to Alfredo because this is his expertise. Well, no, actually, we're going to talk about the.
No, you can go.
I don't even know my own presentation. forget what's next.
Actually, you're very good at this, so I know they're getting a lot of information.
Okay, this is more sort of like consultant to airline stuff, but I'll go over it nonetheless. When you're talking to the big airlines, especially if you're in the tourism industry, you're in a big market, you want to be focusing on the big carriers. They're going after lots of connecting passengers. They're going after big city pairs, but they have a higher cost of operation. So getting them to come into your market, if you don't have them already, is going to be a lot more challenging than it was in the past. Again, fewer pilots, you know, fewer planes, you know, all the doom and gloom that people are spewing. But if you're also a destination market and you're looking at increasing your inbound travel and tourism, this is where these other guys come into play. The Spirits, the Allegiants, the Frontier. I mean, they really are the next best things in sliced bread if you're trying to bring in traffic, because they bring in really low fares, they have a low cost of operation, and most importantly, they're growing. So who cares if they're only growing 1% versus, so who cares if they only represent 1% of the capacity of the nation? If they're bringing 50 flights to your market, you know, embrace them with open arms, because they're gonna be transformational. And, you know, I have no insider knowledge, but I theorize that over time, if we look sort of 20, 30 years in the future, I think our industry is gonna look a lot different. I think while the network carriers today still offer first class or business class, whatever you wanna call it, economy, I think the industry is clearly going in the direction of the Allegiant Spirit Sun Country model. So you're gonna see a continued unbundling of fares, unbundling meaning that airlines are going to increasingly charge for just the services that people want to use. Mm-hmm. And I think that much like, you know, those of us who've been around for a while, you know, look back to the 70s and 80s as the glory days, and I'll remember when, you know, in first class we were serving caviar and all this stuff. Well, like, I think that we're going to look at today as the glory days, and we're going to see in 20 years, oh, remember when you actually got a meal in first class? That's even if they have first class. Because I just think we're going to see a lot of things that are much different. And, you know, these guys on the right here are really a good preview of where I think the industry is going. And you see it in Europe. I think if you're flying around Europe and you're flying, you know, Club World on BA as an example, that product, while nice relative to the economy product, it's just a lot different than what we still see in the U.S. I think geography will play to, you know, kind of the future, because we have a much bigger market geographically, but enjoy it while it lasts. it's not going to be around forever. That's my prediction.
So
now you're part.
Some of you that know me, when I worked in Fort Lauderdale, I worked for the CBB, not knowing back then in 2000 that there was an opportunity as a CBB to work directly with the airport attracting service. I got invited to an airline conference in Greece, and I remember sitting in a room and asking a question. Somebody says, "You're not an airport." I'm like, "Oh, really?" I said, "But if that airplane that I fill with tourists and through tour operators, and why would that not be important?" And somebody goes, "Well, what are you talking about?" I said, "Well, I'm here listening to you guys talk about landing and the gas and all these words I didn't know what they had." And I said, "But if the plane is empty, who benefits?" I said, I go to tour operators and I talk to them. I say, look, I come to my destination, but if they're coming from Greece or Europe, they needed to fly. So that kind of got the ball rolling. And over 15 years, airlines like Emirates are flying to Fort Lauderdale. British Airways was flying to Fort Lauderdale. The whole network of Spirit, they started hub to Central America. But that happened because we were able to get the agencies to understand that they needed to work together. That's the airport and the CVB. We had a little bit of an advantage in Fort Lauderdale because we also had a very large seaport. So if you know one of the Royal Caribbean ships that has 6,000 passengers, multiply that by 13 departures on a Saturday and Sunday, do the numbers. We needed, I think that we estimated that to fill one Royal Caribbean, you needed 22 737s.
Wow.
So there was even no way that we can actually try to fill all those passengers into the ship, even if they got on the same day. So we actually had to extend these pre- and post-tourism cruise programs. The passengers arrived on Friday or Thursday or Wednesday, and then the same thing on the backside. But it was a collaborative effort because the airport allowed the CVB to work with them. Then the seaport said, yo, this is great. You're helping us bring the people to the cruises. And then the last engine, what called the four-legged stool, was the Office of Economic Development that helped us, and we'll see this in a minute, create the incentives for the airline. The airlines, what they were trying to do back then, and you mentioned it, they did not make a lot of money in 2000. As a matter of fact, every year, the big airlines would say, well, how much money did we lose? And it was, oh, well, we only lost $2 billion this year. Great, because we lost $3 billion last year. Well, that has changed dramatically because the airlines are making money. Even the Southwest and the Spirits are making tons of money. So let's go to the next slide. So the airlines, when they're trying to do, and this is where we come in, they need to minimize the risk of a startup. Startups are extremely expensive because they have to put personnel, they have to get ground handling, they have to get the cleaning services, they have to do all the things that they have to do. That is expensive. Most of the time when they start, they hire a company to do them. Some airlines do their own. So any help that the airline gets, they will appreciate. So there's different types of incentives. Let's go to the next slide. There's what we call fee waivers. The airport operates at a cost. So that's the runway, the counters, the light, the electricity. Most airports right now have incentives where the airline doesn't have to pay the landing fees. They don't have to pay for the counter. They don't have to pay for the gates. But they do. They don't do that forever. Sometimes it's a one-year contract. Sometimes maybe they'll extend it to a two-year contract. But then there's all these other things that the airlines are looking to get help with. And so depending on the size of the airport, they can afford to pretty much give them everything they want. Some smaller airports don't have that ability, and they'll do like what they normally do, which is the fee waivers, because that's actually, the airport's already there, the runway's already there, just might as well just let them use it. But what the airline wants after this is us in the tourism world to help them. Most of the time it's money for marketing. Most of the time it's support in the destination where the plane is coming from. And that's where we again jump in and say, yes, we have a network of operators. We have a network of travel agents that we work in a certain market. Let's go do a campaign together. Let's do a roadshow. Let's bring some PR with media. That's what the airline is looking for. Always for one thing. Risk reduction. They need to reduce that risk in order to be A, successful, and two, sustainable over time.
How do the airports make up the revenue that they're giving up?
They have a thing called the PFC, Passenger Facility Charge.
Yep.
And that is, somebody mentioned it yesterday. Was Roger mentioned something about the PFC?
Yeah.
So basically that has been a flat fee. Is it the PFC is per size of airport, or is it a flat fee?
It's just a flat fee.
Well, they're trying to. I think they're trying to raise the PFC so that the airport gets a little bit more revenue.
Airports want it, airlines don't.
Excuse me.
Of course.
Airports want it.
That's right.
Right.
Right. Because it's fair. That's exactly right.
Like in Europe right now, they're charging all these weird like fees, and the airlines like. The only way we can do this is pass that loss of savings onto the passengers.
So, but Alfredo, when you say risk, so they're looking for reducing risk. But from as a DMO, I'm just going to put, so we have an advantage because we, it's our airport, but we share it sort of with Collier County.
Mm-hmm.
So we've gone in before,
Fort
Myers.
Oh, okay.
We've gone in before and we've put money in together, us as a DMO, Naples, and the airport. But and it happened to us, prime example with Eurowings, they pitched it to us, Düsseldorf, Cologne, and Munich. Based on that, we gave them the money. And then 6 weeks in, oh, Cologne is out, Munich gets reduced, then Munich gets dropped. So we have no sort of guarantee as a destination that
it's
wow investment.
But going to Vegas and rolling the dice.
It is. And it's sad. I mean, I had a, we had a carrier.
Wow.
We had a carrier just this year that announced service from actually to Lauderdale, Daytona Lauderdale. And they wanted money. They wanted the airplane painted. We had a baseball team put the livery. They painted it. It's a great the Tortuga this, Tortuga that. And they flew for 5.5 months. One day I got an email. Schedule change. I'm like, oh, that happens all the time. Schedule change was that they were leaving. So I called the director. I said, how could you even, it takes at least 6 months to get started, much less see how you're going to be successful. And they're like, well, you know, the revenue and the this and the that. I said, yeah, but we paid to put that thing on the plane and this and that. They said, I'm sorry. And no guarantee.
Were you working with a consultant or anyone at the time, or just someone who could do some forecasting?
From our airport, the airport route development team, and they had a consultant at the time. And it was kind of like because the route was taken over by from Air Berlin when Air Berlin went bankrupt.
Right.
So we kind of like, we went very confident because the route's always been successful.
Logical.
But then it just like kept dropping.
But you remember Eurowings was so after that airport. I mean, it didn't look like they would pull out because that's all they wanted forever. For 3 years we worked on that program.
Yeah.
Betsy, you got a question?
We have very sweet ways on how we work because obviously airport cannot give money directly to something that we're promoting to this league.
The FAA doesn't
allow. We can't pay the airport. Right? So, but we cannot write a check. And we had some airlines that they said, oh, I need this money. I know you have money because the airport told us and we want to do this and we just want to promote from the USA out. I said, sorry, we can't do that. No. That was our funding, right?
Well, but that's why I think why in our case we have the three components because we as a DMO, I cannot promote the outbound.
Right.
Yeah.
I can only do inbound.
Right.
So the airport steps in and does all the outbound.
Yeah.
And when it comes to like writing a check, like we're not writing a check, but they're waiving the fees or you know whatever they're lowering their percentage, and then we spent money as in marketing and trying to fill the planes.
Well, I mean, hopefully the money that you spend on marketing to stimulate the market in whatever, let's say it was Germany, hopefully it was a message that everybody saw so that Eurowings was utilizing that and hopefully other people will take advantage, whether it be a Lufthansa or whatever that could pick up that slack, but at least you've marketed your destination. And again, there's no
guarantee.
It's
just hard to justify it as a DMO
it is,
to our stakeholders and our board.
It
to
is
say
painful.
You spent $1.2 million between, you know, visit Florida, grant and everything.
I mean, Rafa, you've seen it. I don't know.
Yeah.
It's tough because maybe 20 years ago, incentives were sort of what maybe was the tipping point for an airline deciding to come to a market. But today, they really are almost expected. And I think that's primarily because, again, 20 years ago, the economy was in a much different place. And so airlines were looking for the profitable routes. As you mentioned, I think we had an earlier slide, everything's profitable today. And so now airlines are picking from the best of the best. It's no longer, you know, what's going to make me money, and so as a result they can be picky and choosy, and they wield a lot of power. I mean, frankly, they do. I mean, they can come to you and say, you know, write us a check or else, and if not, we're going to go someplace else.
Yeah.
And you just have to be judicious about
Columbus saw it with Continental when Columbus was a hub, and the airport put in a lot of money out of the new terminal and everything, and with the merger Columbus is closed as a hub, so the airport is pretty much empty.
Then you have the competition where the flights just come in to drive out another airline.
Yeah,
right.
Oh. Which is what actually happened because BA is no longer in for Arnell because they drove out Norwegian from their Gatwick.
That's why it's so sensitive. It's a very sensitive topic, as we always call it, and that leaks at the airport, especially when you say, oh, an airline contacts you and says, we would like to fly there. You can't tell anybody, because if another airline finds out, they try to cut in. It's doggy dog. Okay, so let's go to, the next slide that we wanted to look at. So, we'll mention it that the airline industry is changing, but it's changing with technology, it's changing with the city pairings, it's changing with cost of fuel, it's changing with security, everything else. So we just kind of thought of put a couple little things here that we can kind of show us where this is going.
Sure.
So you guys remember Mr. Neelman?
Yeah.
So Mr. Neelman started JetBlue back in 1999. First flight was JFK Fort Lauderdale. Then he met somebody in Brazil. He moved to Brazil and started Azul. Same thing, the same model, low fare. Well, he's back. He's going to start right now. They don't know. It's the name of the company. I guess called Breeze, but it could be Moxie. What Neelman is going to do is he's going to target secondary airports. That's what's for us, especially in Florida. He's looking at multiple cities in Florida, and it's not going to be the hub airports. So your airport, my airport, not your airport. but they're looking at secondary pairings, and he's
Ocala.
Got Ocala. Yeah. but he's looking, has already ordered 60 Airbuses. I think it's 60 that he ordered.
Yeah.
And it just, and again, he wants to do the low fare with service package, because the complaint, number one complaint is, oh, I have to fly Spirit, but whatever, and you know, service. Well, he wants to change the model. It's all about the service. It's all about this sexy look and everything. I think it, you know, he knows how to do this. So.
And the name's going to be Moxie?
That's kind of the code name for it. I don't know if that's really going to be what it's called.
Okay.
But the strategy, it's really not much different than what Southwest and Frontier have done. So it used to be that secondary airports really were that. They were secondary. Well, now the secondary airports are full, and so he's going in and finding what used to be maybe third-tier airports, but not the third tier or the secondary. Yeah. Yeah. So this is a preview of the future.
And then we have, who else? We had another one, right?
So we have Extra. Haven't really heard much about these guys. In fact, this slide's almost a year old, but I was looking into them recently. The last I heard, they are trying to secure their funding, but suffice to say, their model is going to be similar to Moxie. So just another ultra-low-cost carrier coming in.
And they were purchasing older airplanes from Southwest and other carriers and redesigning the interior of this.
I believe so. Yeah, and I don't, like, they're not going to be called Extra. I mean, they've made that pretty clear. It's going to be called something else. So just something to watch out for. The narrative is that there are new airlines on the horizon. They're going to come in and they're going to address the growing market. But that's buttressed against pilot shortage and all these other things. So it'll be interesting to see how that works.
The budget carriers will really not compete with the legacy carriers, because the legacy carriers, their load factors are ridiculously high. So they will be competing amongst themselves.
That's right.
Do you see it like, okay.
And then you're going to see like unique city pairings. That's going to be, I think the key is going to be able to service markets that have not been serviced. And if you looked at the hub model, if you live within 150 miles of Newark, you knew that that's where an airline would not fly. And then you have like Stewart Airport in upstate New York, actually low state New York.
Iceland.
Norwegian decided to fly to Stewart. They said, we're not going to go compete in the JFK market. We're not going to compete in New York. Forget it. We'll go to Stewart. So now you have Stewart to Dublin. And again, because they found that you could service that market, the catchment area is big enough, let it happen.
So stay tuned. I think it'll be an intriguing decade with all these upstarts coming along. So what else is going on? So we have Cape Air, which is introducing an electric plane. I believe like Sweden has already mandated that in the next, I don't forget what year it is, but essentially
2025.
Yeah. So, and listen, I mean, it, the technology maybe isn't necessarily proven yet, but it's a good thing. I mean, I know I'm all about the environment as I'm drinking my plastic water bottle, but we have to be focused on the environment, and I think this is a step in the right direction. I hope over time that this technology will increase, because I think it's going to not only benefit you know, the planet in that sense, but most importantly, just the efficiency of the industry. And so if we look really way into the future, we have the Jetsons and Uber Air is here.
Right,
the flying cars. But the reason we included this is because, yes, I mean, it's kind of fun, whimsical, but I think this sort of speaks to potentially the direction that the industry could go in if we project even beyond, you know, 20 plus 30 years. I think it's going to be more about... Well, they're developing essentially like a helicopter.
Like a helicopter. Okay.
Yeah. I mean, it's. But I think this will translate over time into a world where, yes, we'll still have airports and hubs and all that kind of stuff, but it's going to be.
It's not a good time to launch it right now.
Right. Not yet.
Give it another month.
I know somebody tried to start an app for private pilots to offer, you know, if I was flying from here to Nashville and.
I've heard of that.
Planes.
What is that?
I can't remember, but did that take off?
Well, it is. Well, there's a company that was started in California, and they're down in Dallas, JetSuite X, that sort of on demand service, you know, group sharing for private jets.
Right.
I won't speak to their business model because I'm not well versed in their financial plan and how that works. But you have some people who say, oh God, this is going to be great. Other people are saying that maybe it's a little shaky. I'm not really sure. As I said, I'm not an expert on sort of what their direction is. I think it's an intriguing concept, though. I think the biggest limitation for this in general is going to be how do you combine sort of this huge commercial aviation market with all these planes coming and going with, you know, this proliferation of all these small aircraft in the airspace. Exactly. So, I mean, I think that's something that authorities worldwide are working on.
Is Hyperloop on the radar?
I hope so.
So what's, I'm sorry?
Hyperloop?
So that's the Elon Musk. Yeah. So it's, remember like the James, I forget what James Bond movie it was, but the James Bond movie where he gets in the Hyperloop and there's like a 1985 or something. So there's that. Yes. And then the other thing that I think will impact airlines is the advent of the high-speed rail. So Texas is working on that right now. California has plans, a lot of places. But I don't think the high-speed rail in of itself will supplant the growth of aviation in this country because, again, of geography. We're not set up to have high-speed rail between, you know, New York and L.A. But it is something that in these short-haul markets, I think it will have an impact. So that's it.
That's it, guys. I don't know. Yes, Brandon.
It seems like you guys focus a lot on domestic airlines, but so international is kind of what I'm looking at now, and especially for international service. What's going on? What trends do you guys see going on in the international market?
Well, I guess in your legacy carriers internationally right now are being dominated by the big three, Qatar, Etihad, and Emirates. They're creating this, what I call the golden funnel through Dubai and Abu Dhabi. I don't know how big that's going to get. I mean, I've already heard that Emirates is not going to be growing at the same pace as they have for the last 10 years. They're actually kind of running out of money. But
I think that business model is, so connecting people in the Middle East, I don't want to say it's going to be obsolete, but I think it's going to become increasingly less relevant than it is today. And again, this is just my take on this. I think it's because you have new planes like the A350 that can fly so freaking far. I mean, you've got
3 hours in the air.
Right. You've got Qantas where you spend an entire day flying from London to Perth. So the whole business model for those international carriers was it was a way of sort of connecting the world at a central location where you could accommodate the, you know, the aircraft range at the time. But I think that you're going to see airlines increasingly flying, overflying that and just doing their own long-haul thing. The other thing I would say is on the foreign carriers, the U.S. sort of went through the pain first as far as restructuring. We experienced this economic bloodbath, you know, in the 2000s. And now you see that happening in Europe. So I think Europe in many respects is still going through that restructuring. Asia is sort of, you know, even farther back in that. They have all these low cost carriers that have that are flying locally.
You're meaning that there'll be some consolidation?
Right. Right. So I see the Asian marketplace as being kind of where the US was in the early 90s. Europe is kind of where we were in the early 2000s and where we are now. And that's not a you know, one's good, bad, better. It's just more structurally, where are they in sort of the timeline of the evolution of the industry. And there's a whole host of reasons for why that's the case. And we just, there were structural reasons why it impacted the US first.
I mean, in the medium long haul, not the 22-hour flights, if we look at for your market in Georgia, you look at north and south. So you're going to see like the companies like Moxie that are going to be using these XLRs on a 240-seater going all the way to Buenos Aires, Santiago. That's for your immediate, what I call mid-range. And then, of course, if you look at the going east towards Europe, again, it's going to be equipment. The A350 is going to be a game changer. That, how many seats in that thing?
So it's similar to like a, yeah. I mean, it's a fantastic plane. I mean, it's very, very
now there. Everybody's now competing to see who's got the longest flight. I mean, God, I don't want to be in row 67 in the middle seat for 22 hours.
Yeah, at least you don't smoke in the plane anymore. So
right.
Can you imagine for 22 hours?
Hey, I just found out that there's seats to the back now.
No one wants to be a deep coach and fly that long. Yeah.
So I've heard a lot of talk that in terms of infrastructure, traffic air control, and sort of updating technology to manage more volume in the air is a big thing. And I don't know if this is true or not, but I heard that the U.S. is sort of behind in that modernization. What are your thoughts about,
you know,
air traffic control?
That's possible. I again, not my area of expertise, but I know that. Are there any pilots in here? Maybe anyone who has flying experience? Okay, so I guess I'm it.
There's a shortage, remember?
Yeah, there's a shortage. They're all flying the planes. They're not here.
Thank you, honey. That's good.
But, I know. Thank you for being
that's
here.
That's salary, though.
You
say we're all here anyway.
I do know that there are air traffic control. You know, the government, U.S. government, FAA tried to redesign, and it took years and years and years and gross over budget, tell surprise. But now you see like RNAV approaches, and I think that's the terminology. But essentially what it is it allows more precision in approaches. So it better utilizes the airspace around a major congested hub. So whereas before you'd come into a hub and you'd fly, you know, 50 miles out, turn around and come back in, now maybe, you know, it's more direct. And it just allows air traffic control to space more planes in that smaller
But is space. The air traffic, the airspace also being controlled by the fact that there's more extension in service? Now you have airplanes
right.
flying 24 hours a day.
Right, right. So I don't know if anyone looks at Flight Radar 24. I mean, you can just sit there if you're like me, just spend like hours watching that thing. I mean, it speaks to your point. I mean, there's just massive planes everywhere. Any other questions?
We've got 5 minutes. Anyone? Questions? Future? Past? Howard, tell us a story. How were the Wright brothers? Cool?
So why cool. has the demise of the A380 just... I mean, it was billed as, okay, instead of having 10 planes going... Well, not 10 planes, but instead of having two flights going in from London to wherever, you'd have
right.
one, because they could all fit on one plane. But now it's...
I think when that plane was developed, Airbus hoped that the future would be, as you say, the larger planes of fewer frequencies. That has proven to be true in airports like Heathrow and Sydney and Hong Kong, where you have restricted space. It's also been true for places like LAX, where maybe there's so much demand that you really can't accommodate. The problem with the A380 is that as fuel prices increased, it's a very expensive plane to operate. So it's wonderful that Air France can fill up Paris, Montreal during the summertime with an A380. But what in Sam heck do you do with that plane in the wintertime? So if you can't fill that plane during the off-peak season, you're flying around a plane that has, while on a per-seat basis, it's actually pretty inexpensive. So if you compare that with, say, a smaller plane, on paper it looks cheap. But wait a minute, you got to add up all those seats in the plane, multiply it times that cost, and then all of a sudden you've got this huge bill that you're paying because you couldn't fill the plane. And that's why you see a lot of the airlines parking them, for lack of a better term. And I think you'll still continue to see airlines flying them to Heathrow, but I mean, the writing's on the wall.
They stopped making the A380, right?
Yeah. There's a few that they have left to make, but yeah, I mean, Emirates was ready to order a whole bunch more, but Airbus just couldn't make a business case for continuing the production. And so now Emirates is going more towards the 787, 777, the new 777.
Yeah.
With the shortage of pilots, are there still any planes that require a three-man cockpit? I don't know if the 47-400s.
So none of the planes today physically require two people. I think the issue more is just the crew rest on long-haul flights. You need, you know, three sets of
pilots.
But
it's not required to have a flight engineer anymore.
Right. Well, I mean, look, actually, technology-wise, we're at a point where we don't need a pilot at all. But I think that's still, that's going to be a bridge too far. But that's another thing. I think I would not be surprised if, you know, down the road we may be in situations where it's one pilot and you've got someone, you know, the man behind the curtain who's like watching the plane if the pilot, something happens. So I don't know. I don't think I'd feel comfortable with that. But.
I gotta go to the bathroom. Can a flight attendant look over?
Right.
It's autopilot.
Right.
For a long time.
Yeah. Well, thank you guys. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much,
Will.
Survey questionnaire.
All
things. And have a great day.
For you, yes.
Yeah, put it. Don't put me.